You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. On today's episode, there's going to be two interviews. First interview will be Kimberly Tay interviewing Douglas Ritchie from the United Kingdom about slow cities.
I think it's probably important to emphasize that cheetah slow is very much a state of mind. There are these 55 different criteria you've got to meet. You've got to tick the boxes, as it were, against them. It's always said to me in the early days of Perth membership application, the very fact that a town is thinking of becoming a cheetah slow town shows that it's already thinking along the right lines.
And the other interview is slightly controversial. I've interviewed Daniel Dontremont about problems he's been having with wind turbines in his Nova Scotia neighborhood.
We have an extended family in the area. So our children were going to school, and the other kids were asking them, well, why did you move? Why did you leave your home? And they were saying, because of the wind farm. And the kids were telling them, it's not true, you're lying, you know? Mm-hmm. So all that, it was so hard. Hard on us, hard on the kids, like, to be called liars, to, you know?
Yeah.
For your own community, for members of your community not to believe you.
That song is Like a Mountain, and it's by Moira. Today's episode of Sustainable Futures has two things. It has a feel-good story, and it has a question what you believe story. The first is with Douglas Ritchie and Kimberly Tay. This is one of her interviews before she went on to other pastures from this show. This is one of the wonderful things she left behind with her. It's an interview with Douglas Ritchie about slow cities. These are cities that change their pace of life and bring more of a local community to them. In Europe, this is catching on really, really well. And Kimberly took on the angle of asking about North America and why is this not happening in North America, and also learning about what slow cities really is.
Today I am speaking with Douglas Ritchie. And Douglas, you initiated and managed Perth's successful bid to become Scotland's first cheetah slow town. Earlier this year, you also managed Linlithgow's bid to become Scotland's second cheetah slow town. My tendency is to call it a cheetah slow town, but I know that it's not. It's a cheetah slow town?
Cheetah slow town. Bring out your inner Italian.
Okay. I'll try my best. Cheetah slow town. Awesome. Now, you're also a member of the Cheetah Slow Perth Steering Group, and you also live in Perth.
Yes, indeed I do.
Now, the reason why I'm interested in this whole sort of cheetah slow movement and also the slow food movement is that it's kind of just starting up here in North America, and there isn't actually a slow city here or one that has actually been, you know, has met the requirements and actually been called a cheetah slow town. So I think that North American cities have a lot to learn from the whole movement. So that's why, in particular, I'm really interested in that. Could you tell me, maybe just to start off with, what the history of the slow town movement is?
The cheetah slow movement originally grew out of the slow food movement. Now, slow food was initially set up in Italy in the late 1980s, very much as, I suppose, a reaction to what was seen as being the unhealthy elements of fast food culture. And slow food really tries to encourage people to put the buying, the preparing, the eating and the sharing of food as a central part of family and of social life. And the hope is that people who follow slow food philosophy will try and buy locally produced food. They'll take time to prepare it. They'll take time to enjoy it. And really, by taking time, they'll get more out of eating. And what happened was there were a number, started off with actually four towns in Italy who wanted to adopt slow food principles. And when they thought about slow food and its principles, they also thought they should really look at wider environmental aspects of living. They should look at issues like sustainability, things like hospitality, things like community involvement. These four towns were the first four cheetah slow towns in the world. And they formed Cheetah Slow in 1999. And since then, it's grown and developed at a much faster rate than anyone imagined. So, and there are now 104 Cheetah Slow towns in 15 countries across the world.
That's an incredible number.
I think actually the Italians themselves have been very surprised at how quickly it's grown. And they've been surprised, I suppose, that there's been a common interest in the sort of principles and the philosophy of Cheetah Slow in so many different countries across the world. Because there are now Cheetah Slow towns in South Korea, in Australia, in Spain, in Norway, in all kinds of different places with very different cultures and very different backgrounds. But all of these towns have adopted the same set of principles and guiding philosophy to become cheetah slow towns.
That's fantastic. And hopefully here in North America, it will start to catch on as well.
We would hope so. At the moment, there are, as far as I'm aware, no cheetah slow towns anywhere in North America.
Yeah.
And that is possibly the next area for us to focus on to try and recruit some towns.
Yeah, my understanding, or I heard from one of the women from Vancouver's slow food group, that a town called Cowichan Bay had applied to become a cheetah slow town.
Ah.
But it hadn't gone through yet, and I've tried to do a bit of digging and contact them, but haven't come up with anything yet as to what stage of the process they're in or anything like that. So hopefully that would be really cool if Canada had North America's first slow town.
That would be really good. One of the key things about being a cheetah slow town is you have to be a smaller town. It's for towns with populations of less than 50,000 people. Because I think one of the ideas of Cheetah Slow is it very much is about smaller towns retaining their own identity and their own infrastructure of local shops, local restaurants, and local services. And it's really, I suppose, Cheetah Slow is about helping smaller towns find their place in the world and being able to find a place in the world that lets them stand out from the larger cities.
So maybe could you expand on some of the other goals that a town has to meet in order to be called a cheetah slow town?
Yes, certainly. I mean, in the UK, the way it works is every town that applies to become a cheetah slow town in the UK has to address 55 different membership criteria. And they cover things like the environment. Every cheetah slow town, for example, has got to measure its air quality, its water quality. It's got to have steps in place to encourage home composting, recycling, and things like that. We've also got to look at the infrastructure of our town to make sure that it's got good public transport systems, it's got public seating in places, it's got well-kept parks and green areas. We've got to look at the urban fabric of our town, which is very much about encouraging eco-friendly architecture, maintaining our historic buildings and bringing old buildings into new uses rather than just knocking them down and rebuilding all the time. There's also one of the key elements of Cheetah Slow is supporting local produce and local products, and that includes having things like farmers markets in our towns, having regular craft fairs, working with local businesses to try and raise awareness of what they produce and encourage local people to buy locally. Cheetah Slow Town also has to have measures in place to ensure that visitors to the town get a warm welcome, that there's proper signposting for visitors, there's proper parking for visitors, things like that. And also it's very important with a Cheetah Slow Town that the whole community is involved in Cheetah Slope. It's not just a few people sort of leading this idea, but it's very much a grassroots thing where community groups and local business organisations and everybody in the town is involved in the Cheetah Slope effort. So that's the sort of kind of things that you have to do to become a Cheetah Slope town. As I say, there's 55 individual criteria that you have to address, but it's recognised that no town is going to meet all of the Cheetah Slope criteria to begin with. So initially you are assessed and you have to be sort of seen to be addressing at least half of the different Cheetah Slope criteria. And then basically Cheetah Slope comes back in 3 years' time to see how you're getting on with the ones that you didn't meet the first time. So that's really how it's organised. In the case of Perth, it took us about a year to achieve Cheetah Slope status. And it involved, well, literally dozens of local community groups and organisations in the effort.
Wow. It is quite a process to actually get it recognised as a Cheetah Slope town.
So that's one of the good things. I think it's probably important to emphasise that Cheetah Slope is very much a state of mind. There are these 55 different criteria you've got to meet, and you've got to tick the boxes, as it were, against them. It's always said to me in the early days of Perth membership application, the very fact that a town is thinking of becoming a Cheetah Slope town shows that it's already thinking along the right lines. It's already thinking about things like recycling. It's already thinking about environmental protection. It's already thinking about protecting its old buildings. It's already thinking about supporting its local producers. So it's very much a state of mind. And most towns who apply to become Cheetah Slope towns are already part of the way there. So it's not as though you're really starting from nowhere.
When you think about your experiences in Perth and then Linlithgow, were there any sort of people who were kind of against that, or was it challenging to get everybody thinking the same way?
The interesting thing, I think, particularly in Perth initially, was when we said to people, we want to become a slow town, some people thought, what exactly does that mean? Because we want to be a dynamic, vibrant city.
Yeah.
And it was hard to get across the message. No, being slow means that you just take time to do things a wee bit better. And there's no reason why you can't be slow and also be dynamic. And it was also, I suppose, a question of getting across the message that being a slow town doesn't mean that you're anti-technology or you're anti the modern world or anything like that. Because Cheetah Slope towns, I mean, one of the criteria for being a Cheetah Slope member town is that you've got a website that anyone can access for information about your town and about Cheetah Slope in your town. And Cheetah Slope really looks to use modern technology in a human way, where we control the technology rather than the technology controls us. So there were some people who were a wee bit uneasy about the term slow town to begin with. But once we were able to sit down and explain it to them, we found actually there was a great deal of local community support for becoming a Cheetah Slope town. And without that support, we couldn't have progressed.
This is Kimberly Tay interviewing Douglas Ritchie about slow cities.
For sure. So a lot of it is just helping people realize that perhaps the way that we have been doing things isn't necessarily the best way to be doing things, and slowing things down a little bit is a healthier way of living.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, we've got a little slogan we say sometimes, which is slow down and enjoy life. You miss more than just the scenery by going too fast. And I think that's true. You miss out on all the things that life's got to offer if you just speed through it all the time. And sometimes it's good just to stop, do things a bit more slowly, take stock, look at the world around you, stop, as I say, stop and smell the roses, because it's much more pleasurable to live life that way.
Do you think that North America faces a challenge then of bringing more Cheetah slow towns to North America?
Possibly. I mean, to be honest, North America is the home of the fast food culture. That maybe presents a wee bit of a challenge. But I'm sure there are many communities in North America which are really looking to establish their own identity to ensure that they have a high quality of life and ensure that people like living there, they like working there, they like visiting there. And Cheetah Slope can help do that. And I think also one of the great things we found about Cheetah Slope in both Perth and Linlithgow is that it very much brings the community together. It brings people together to work on joint initiatives, joint projects. And suddenly people are talking to each other in ways that they weren't talking before, and they're finding out more about each other. And that really strengthens community life.
Mm-hmm. So it builds on that, the community that perhaps was not there before or that was there just sort of strengthens that.
A mixture of both. I mean, what we found in particular in Perth with Cheetah Slope was it brought together people from different departments of our council, our local authority, who were doing broadly similar things but didn't know it, and didn't really know that there were people in the next or the office sort of two doors down the corridor who were working on similar things. And suddenly it brought a lot of information out to the open where people sort of said, oh, you're interested in that, so am I, perhaps we can work together and do something better together. That's been one of the great aspects of Cheetah Slough. It's really brought people together to work together much more effectively.
That's fantastic. And I think that that's something that, you know, we're missing in our modern society. Not only is it too fast, but we don't take the time to work together as well and build that community. And that's a really important aspect, I think, that we're missing out on.
Yeah, I think possibly people nowadays are under, always feel as though they're under time pressure. And time pressure often means that you don't do things as well as you could do if you took a little time, little more time to do them better. And I think one of the part of the Cheetah Slough philosophy is very much take time and do things properly rather than rushing them. Because if you rush things, you make mistakes. And if you take a little bit more time, you can have a longer lasting impact and you can have more enjoyment doing it as well.
For sure. So as a resident of Perth, how have you experienced, what has the change been like for you? What have you experienced on the ground happening in Perth?
Well, there's been a number of things, I suppose. I mean, we have a number of projects ongoing in Perth. Things like there's been new recycling initiatives. I've just had three new bins delivered to my house, which will enable me to recycle a lot more of my domestic waste, for example. There's been a big increase in interest in home composting. So we all now get home composting bins as well. In terms of other projects, in Cheetah Slough, Perth, we do quite a lot of work with local schools to try and encourage young people to take more of an interest in the food that they eat. And we've got local schools which have got projects now where they are building vegetable beds, they're growing vegetables, and then the kids have got chefs coming in to show them how to cook the vegetables, and the kids are actually going on to prepare gala dinners for up to 100 people and so forth, and are getting that confidence about preparing food, growing food, and then sharing that food with other people. So there's been quite a lot of good initiatives like that. It's also helped us to attract actually new businesses to the town as well, more sort of green-related businesses. We found just recently we've now got the Royal Geographical Society of Scotland is relocating to Perth into one of our old buildings. And it was the fact that we are a Cheetah Slough town was one of the things that appealed to them to move to Perth. So it's been actually good for inward investment as well. So it's really affected and influenced and helped all different levels of the community.
That's really cool. Do you think that in some cases the Cheetah Slough movement could be considered a tourist marketing strategy rather than actually a full-on change of thinking?
Yes, it could be, I suppose. And one of the things we do hope, and we are actually finding a wee bit in Perth already, is that some people will come to the town because it's a Cheetah Slough town, because they expect to be able to find things like a farmer's market. They expect to be able to find good restaurants that are using local produce. And we're hoping to develop tourism links between the different Cheetah Slough towns across Europe so that, for example, if somebody comes from Germany over to Scotland and lives in a Cheetah Slough town in Germany, they'll want to visit the Cheetah Slough towns in Scotland and so forth. So there is a tourism element to it. But basically, I suppose, local community involvement and local community participation is one of the fundamental building blocks of a Cheetah Slough town. So it is very much for the local residents, as much, if not more so, than for visitors.
Mm-hmm. And when you're talking about that a Cheetah Slough town has to be small, under 50,000 in
yep.
population, are there elements, though, of the movement and, you know, the philosophy of a Cheetah Slough town that a large city could learn from?
I'm sure there are. I mean, for example, Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland, is far too large to be a Cheetah Slough town, but Edinburgh has set up a farmer's market. Edinburgh is trying to do different recycling initiatives and so forth, is trying to encourage greater use of public transport. So all these kind of things are Cheetah Slough related. And what can happen for larger towns or regions which are too big to be Cheetah Slough members, they can become Cheetah Slough supporters, which basically means they're just stating that they support the principles of Cheetah Slough. So, for example, in the case, Perth is a town of about 45,000 people, so it's small enough to be a Cheetah Slough town. Perth is the centre of the area of Perth and Kinross, which is a sort of large geographical regional area. And Perth and Kinross is a Cheetah Slough supporter, basically to say that all, the whole of the Perth and Kinross region supports the principles of Cheetah Slough. So larger conurbations, larger cities, larger regions can also support the Cheetah Slough principles.
Oh, that's really fantastic. Because I do think that there are, like, a city for, like, Vancouver, for example, which has over a million people, there, I think that there are elements of the philosophy that you can really take into the larger city and use it to create somewhat of a, you know, a healthier society for us to live in.
I think you're right. What could also happen, and is starting to happen, I think particularly in Germany and Poland, is that in some of the larger cities, what's happening is that smaller neighbourhoods are trying to sort of apply for Cheetah Slow membership. So maybe there's, you know, Vancouver's got a million people in, but there might be smaller neighbourhoods with smaller populations which could be Cheetah Slow members.
Oh, that's really interesting. So even within the big cities, they have smaller communities getting involved as well. That's really cool, actually.
Yeah, because I would imagine Vancouver will be very similar to large cities over here, where that, okay, there's a city centre, but there's also a number of other smaller shopping centres and leisure centres and libraries and schools in more localised areas of each city. And there's no reason why that smaller localised area couldn't be a Cheetah Slow member.
Definitely. So one point that I wanted to touch on a little bit more was the connection between the Cheetah Slow philosophy and movement and environmental sustainability, because I think what's really interesting for me is how the two are so connected. Like, when you take environmental sustainability, it's not, you know, environmental sustainability on its own. It's how slowing down can contribute to environmental sustainability. Can you elaborate a little bit on that connection?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, protection and maintenance and conservation of the environment, both the natural environment and the built environment, is one of the sort of key tenets of Cheetah Slow. And as I mentioned previously, I mean, if you want to be a Cheetah Slow town, you've got to take a number of steps to protect the environment, from, you know, monitoring your air quality, your water quality, reducing your light pollution, things like that, and protecting your old buildings. And for example, in Perth, we found that being a Cheetah Slow town has helped to raise awareness of environmental issues and has encouraged more recycling. In Perth now, we recycle almost 40% of our domestic waste, which is about double the Scottish average, and we've also set up all kinds of new recycling facilities for our local businesses. So very much we see Cheetah Slow and environmental sustainability going hand in hand. Well, actually, one of the reasons why Perth was interested in being a Cheetah Slow town was because we recognise the importance particularly of the natural environment of our area. We are basically an agricultural area, and the quality of our land, the quality of our water, is key to the success of our local farmers. And we saw basically becoming a Cheetah Slow town would help to raise awareness of the importance of protecting our local environment, because it makes business sense as much as anything else. So protection of the environment and environmental sustainability is a key part of Cheetah Slow. And as part of Cheetah Slow Perth, we are looking at doing things like green gyms. I don't know if you've come across these yet in North America, where the idea is that people get together and adopt an area of ground which perhaps is needing to be maintained a bit better, tidied up, litter picked, new plants put in it and so forth. And they go out at their lunchtime and they basically look after this part of ground, this piece of ground. And through doing that, they get exercise, they get healthier, so it helps the environment, it helps the individual health, and that's why we call it green gyms. And they're becoming increasingly popular.
That's really cool. There are so many really, really interesting, very innovative things. I would say innovative, but yet it's not so innovative in that these are things that people have done for centuries before us that we're sort of rediscovering now.
I think you're totally right. I think, you know, a lot of Cheetah Slow is quite simply common sense, and it's small things that anybody can do. But by doing a lot of small things, we can have a big impact. And I think that's what it's really about. That's why Cheetah Slow is very much a grassroots movement. It's about individuals making small changes to their life, which have a larger impact in the wider world. And that's where I think Cheetah Slow is both successful and enjoyable to be part of, because it inspires people and they can actually see that there's things that they can do themselves. It's not a case of somebody else in a bigger organization doing things for them, but just by making small changes in their own lives, they can make a big change to the world.
Well said. What have you enjoyed most about the process?
What have I enjoyed most about the process? The people involved in it. Just meeting more people, getting a lot of sort of very imaginative and innovative ideas from people, and just, I suppose, getting to know my own area better. I mean, for me personally, it has actually changed my life. Just the way I buy food now, I spend a lot more time cooking food, so I spend a lot more time preparing food. I spend a lot more time going out and getting wild food and foraging for mushrooms, looking for berries and things like that. And it's changed my life to a great extent. But I would say the real joy of it has been working with people and just seeing different projects coming to fruition and the enjoyment and pleasure that people have got from being involved in these projects.
That's great. What I really like is that it seems to bring all these little pieces of the puzzle together, because I think that people can look at building social capacity and community, and then they also look maybe separately at, you know, increasing environmental sustainability, but this brings it all together, which I think is a really, really, really interesting way of going about doing it.
No, I think you're right. I think that is one of the strengths of Cheetah Slow. As you say, it's all different little parts of the jigsaw. Now, no one part of the jigsaw is going to make a big difference on its own necessarily, but by bringing them all together, it can make a big impact. I mean, I'll be honest, the Italians have a very philosophical approach to Cheetah Slow, and they will pontificate for hours and hours about the philosophy of Cheetah Slow. In the UK, we're probably a wee bit more practical, shall we say, and we just go on and do things rather than necessarily think of the philosophy behind them. But we find by doing things, that's what makes a difference.
Awesome. So is there anything else that you would like to mention about the Cheetah Slow movement, your experiences in Perth and Linlithgow that we haven't covered yet?
Not really. I mean, I would just sort of say in summary, Cheetah Slow is actually fun to be involved in, and most people who are involved in Cheetah Slow enjoy being part of it. And most communities that get involved in Cheetah Slow find benefits from being part of it. And I would really hope that we will have a good network of Cheetah Slow towns in North America in the not-too-distant future.
I hope so as well. Thank you so
much. And I hope you Canadians get in there first.
I do too. I expect you to be rooting for us over there in Scotland.
We will be.
Thank you so, so much, Douglas, for sharing your experiences with the Cheetah Slow movement. Thank you so much for being willing to speak with me all the way from Scotland. This has been fantastic. I was really looking forward to this interview for a while because I've been doing a whole series of interviews on the slow movement, and this kind of just kind of caps it off because we don't have this in North America, and I think that it should be here because I think we here could learn a lot from it.
I would hope so. And every 3 years, there's an international congress of all the Cheetah Slow towns across the world. It was held in Italy earlier this year, in June of this year. I hope when we come to hold the one in 2011, there will be some towns from Canada there.
Now, this next interview is with Daniel D'Entremont. He lives in a small town in Nova Scotia where there are now wind turbines. And there are side effects being found, at least that he has found, with wind turbines. And people are now calling this wind turbine syndrome. So as we are taking on this new technology, I thought this would be an interesting story to look at before we get too crazy about harnessing the wind's power. It is easily solvable, but there are certainly aspects to be looked at. And unfortunately, this man's story is going to hopefully be a learning curve for people dealing in wind energy. It's very, very interesting, and I'm quite proud of this one. This is Daniel D'Entremont. This is Ryan Fletcher on Sustainable Futures, and I have Daniel D'Entremont on the line, and we're going to be talking about wind turbine syndrome today, the new energy that is becoming popular, wind energy. There have been some problems that have been coming up. Could you please tell us about the problems you've encountered with wind turbines?
The problems we've encountered are mainly health problems, and we also have the noise issue also. But the health problems are started with the children. Their whole personalities began to change, or they were changing slowly, like teachers were noticing. And after it was mentioned to us, we also noticed the changes in their behaviors. One of them was even, it came to the point that he was going blind for a couple of minutes at a time in one eye or the other. Mm-hmm. And this would happen every few days, but it would never be in both eyes, just it would alternate eyes. And then it came to the point that some mornings he wouldn't be able to get out of bed. His legs weren't moving, so we'd have to physically bring his legs off his bed with his arms and lift himself up, and finally he would be able to walk. Prior to that, he was extremely strong, his eyesight was extremely good. But the only way that We brought him to doctors, and he could find nothing wrong with his eyes or his health. In no way. He was perfectly healthy. But as time progressed, it kept on happening while we were at our home in Pumpkin Cove. Only after we moved away did his condition get better.
How did you come to discover, or at least theorize, that it would be that it's wind turbines?
Well, we came to theorize it was wind turbine because, you know, the teachers were saying, you know, our children are behaving differently in school. The younger children, you know, they wouldn't believe that our children would behave in such a way. And we're doing research on the internet and things like that about wind turbines, and came to discover that other people were suffering same symptoms and things like that. So it gave us consolation or reassurance that we weren't making these up, that it was really happening to us, and that we weren't alone.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little reassuring that we weren't just going crazy.
Were there other people in your immediate area that were experiencing things also?
Our neighbors were experiencing noisy, bothered by the noise and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, over the past few years, they have been complaining about, you know, different symptoms, but they don't really want to associate that with the wind turbines, but
mm-hmm.
I can't see what else it could be.
Mm-hmm. Where does this come from? It seems a bit odd that there's something like problems with eyesight would be connected that way. Do you have any insight as to what is actually going on there?
Well, what we came to figure out with naturopath doctors and other doctors, specialists and things like that, it just this infrasound, low frequency noise, yes.
Yeah.
It's coming, being generated by the turbines, coming through the ground, through the house, and just resonating inside the body, within the body, and creating all these problems, all these nervous problems, these neurological disorders, and things like that.
Hmm.
It was very disturbing to discover that, and my wife developed high blood pressure, ringing in the ears, tingling in the legs,
mm-hmm.
you know, numerous things, headaches, numerous things that were not common that we didn't have before.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always this pulsating feeling within the body, like when you're laying in bed, you always feel these turbines, you feel every revolution. Sometimes it seems like you have to adjust your breathing rhythm to match the turbine noise so that it won't interfere as much with you. And it feels like you're like virtually plugged into these turbines, that this energy is constantly coming through you from them. And it's something that you cannot adapt to. It's always there. It's always disturbing. And the only way to get any rest is to get away, far enough away from the turbines so that they don't bother you.
Mm-hmm. How close is the house to the turbines?
The closest turbine is 300 meters
mm-hmm.
to the house. We have 17 in all in this wind farm. And
17.
The closest is 300 meters. We have one at 400 meters, one at 500. There's a couple at 700 meters.
Mm-hmm.
Two at 800, and things like that. So a lot of them are very close, and they're in a cluster, and the prevailing winds bring everything mm-hmm. towards our home. It was very poor judgment to construct this wind farm there.
Mm-hmm. Is there regulations on how close to build a wind turbine?
Well, the every municipality in Nova Scotia can pass their own bylaws as to how close a turbine should be to a home.
Mm-hmm.
In our case, our municipal council took information from Pincher Creek, Alberta, to draw up their bylaws. And in Alberta, they found out that if a farmer owned land and was leasing it to a wind company, he could put a turbine 300 meters from his house if he owned the land and he was living in that house. But if he was not living in that house, somebody else was living in that house, it wouldn't be allowed to put a turbine closer than 600 meters. From that information, they came back to Nova Scotia and decided on a 300-meter setback. So, and I called the municipality of Pincher Creek, Alberta, and they told me that that would not be allowed in Pincher Creek. So,
mm-hmm.
they went to Pincher Creek for information. They got it wrong. They came back and passed the bylaw allowing a wind farm to be constructed 300 meters from our home.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not negligence on their part, I don't know what to call it.
Yeah. Is there any grounds for legal action that's possible?
I don't think so. We tried to find lawyers to discuss this with, but environmental law is a very touchy subject, and very few lawyers are willing to touch it. So it's very difficult to prove that health problems did come from these wind turbines. Like our family doctor said, you know, he can't prove that these symptoms are a result of the turbines, but he said he would not want to live in our home nor raise children there.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to be involved in this case because it's so controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's hard to scientifically back up everything that has occurred to the family, all the medical problems.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like he's convinced, but he just can't prove it.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah.
And as are many others, like we've brought our children to some naturopathic doctors, and they're all convinced, but they just can't prove it.
Right.
They all advised us to move away and stay away for our own good.
Uh-huh. So where did you get information on other people? Where did you go to get that, the other people that are experiencing these things?
There are some people from Prince Edward Island that have experienced the same thing, like noise and health problems, and usually they were also forced out of their homes.
Yes.
We searched the internet and found it was occurring in England, and spoken to some people from Germany, and they had first-hand information on mm-hmm. the same symptoms with people in those areas. And eventually we contacted Dr. Nina Pierpont from upstate New York, and she was doing a study on the effects of wind turbine noise on people.
Mm-hmm. I guess then it's all connected to noise levels and sort of the low frequency.
Yes.
Is there any research on that subject that's not really connected to wind turbines?
On low-frequency noise?
Yeah.
There's a lot of research on infrasound that's connected to health problems and things like that.
Yeah.
We were in contact with a scientist from Portugal, and she had done extensive research on low-frequency noise and the effects on the human body. And she told us just to get out of there, just to flee and not return.
Mm-hmm.
We discovered there was a lot of noise testing done, a lot of at Pumnico Point from our home, actually. We discovered there was actually some infrasound, enough to upset the body's neurological functions and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the government of Canada refused to admit that it actually did exist. There was some noise testing done by HGC Engineering, a firm from Mississauga, Ontario, and they said that there was no infrasound, but we had our own independent tester come. He's an audiologist from Dalhousie University in Halifax.
Right.
He used the exact same equipment as did the engineering firm, and his interpretation of the data, which I think he's better at interpreting the data, he discovered that there was actually infrasound.
Hmm.
So I was speaking with the representatives from Natural Resources Canada from Ottawa, and prior to the testing, he told me that there was no infrasound associated with wind turbines and that they would find none.
Mm-hmm.
So when the engineering firm came to do the noise testing, of course, they didn't find any because I don't think the government wanted him to find any.
Right, yeah. So you're saying this is a big controversy. Is that correct? This is a big local controversy?
Controversy has spread further
than local.
Than local,
yeah.
The story has gone nationwide, international,
uh-huh.
and people are looking at this area to, we had a pioneers in the effects of wind turbine noise on people. We're the pioneers in Canada, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are the family that has been the most severely affected.
Wow. I imagine it might be a bit difficult, too, in that wind energy is something people associate a lot of positivity towards and something progressive and to be someone that is sort of pointing out problems with it, do you have problems like that where people are like, yeah, but it's wind energy? You're listening to Sustainable Futures, and this is an interview with Daniel D'Entremont about wind turbine syndrome.
Oh, absolutely. Even people, you know, in our own community, like some people don't even believe that what we're saying is true. You know, some people are calling us liars. The wind company, for one, they maintain from day one that we are lying. Everything we're saying is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
In Pumligo, everybody is related. Everybody, a lot of Daltramals and some of the Wynn, two members of the Wynn company were actually people from the community, and they have an extended family in the area. So our children were going to school, and the other kids were asking them, well, why did you move? Why did you leave your home? And they were saying, because of the Wynn farm. And the kids were telling them, it's not true, you're lying, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So all that, it was so hard. Hard on us, hard on the kids, like, to be called liars, to, you know?
Yeah.
For your own community, for members of your community not to believe you. But a lot of the people did believe us, do empathize with us, but, you know, they can't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
The Wynn farm is there. It cannot be moved. Our MLA, Chris Daltramal, who was the Nova Scotia Minister of Health, admitted to us one day that they had made a mistake, but the Wynn farm was not going anywhere. We would have to put up with it and shut up. That's as far as we got with our health minister.
Mm-hmm.
And we've written to our premier, our other ministers in the cabinet, written to federal ministers and things like that. But we haven't had any good responses. Nobody's willing to step out of their comfort zone to put anything on the line to back us up.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a controversial issue.
Right. It's becoming a big industry.
That did write something on her blog to back us up. Like, she condemned mm-hmm. the company for building this wind farm too close and trying to construct others too close also. So,
mm-hmm.
so this company is getting a reputation in Nova Scotia for trying to push their way into communities and putting these wind turbines too close to residences.
What about the people in Prince Edward Island? Has there been much assistance or community support coming from them in their situation?
Well, the last time I talked to them, they were just experiencing all this noise and vibrations and everything in their house, and they couldn't sleep, they couldn't concentrate,
yeah.
and they just had to move out. They just left their homes and moved into a town. I haven't spoken to them since, but as far as I know, they're still out of house and home, and they haven't been helped by anybody. They're on their own. They're getting by.
It would probably be a very similar situation with them, with the small community. And
I did a survey in our community of 216 people out of 2,000, and 96% admitted the wind farm was too close.
Wow.
I think
92%
figured they were too
very
loud
convincing.
Also.
Yeah.
Everybody says wind farm's too close. They don't know why it was built so close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't understand. But they say if the wind company would come again, if it would start anew and they tried to put this wind farm in Pumligo, they would oppose it. They would try to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
They would do their best to stop it.
Right.
And even talked to the Vestas head office in Ontario one day, and I was talking to somebody on the phone, and I was asking them about how close they put wind turbines to houses, and they assured me that the Vestas company had never put a wind turbine 300 meters from a home.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was talking to this person, I was looking at that turbine 300 meters from my house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the attitude they go into a community with, Vestas goes into a community with, is, you know, give them a year of complaint and then they'll shut up. That's what they told us in Pumligo.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Vestas workers told some of the people in Pumligo. You know, give them a year and they'll shut up. And that's their attitude. It just won't do.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. Wow. Okay. Everything else aside, how do you feel about wind energy? Just as a source of energy.
Oh, wind energy is fine.
Yeah.
It has to be tried. I mean, we need to cut down on greenhouse gas emissions, and we have to develop, you know, renewable types of energy. Wind turbines don't seem to be helping too much at this point, but to give them a try, we can't put them too close to people.
Right.
We have to you know, give a 2-kilometer buffer at least. And then we can, you know, we can turn these turbines all we want. It won't be interfering with people's lives, you know.
Yeah. Just to maybe give us an idea, how far away would you be able to hear it from? Or is this a sound that's sort of past the sound barrier? Like, I've never actually been close to a wind turbine, so I'm not familiar with how loud that would actually be.
You know, they won't, it's not loud enough to give you hearing damage. It's just this constant noise.
The constant consistency,
Constant noise and constant vibration. It makes you anxious. It makes you irritable. Mm. You can't think. It comes into your entire being and just, it takes over. You don't have your own thoughts. You just can't ignore it. You can't get away from it.
Mm.
It's always, it's like a haunting, like that's always there. Like, you can run, but you can't hide unless you really go far enough away, like a mile or two.
So what's it been like?
At least 2 kilometers away.
What's it been like since you've moved? Has there been lingering effects?
Pardon me?
Have there been lingering effects?
No. Even our son who was going blind, it took 8 months to a year, but he's totally recovered. Children, their personalities have come back, their self-confidence, their ability to concentrate and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Headaches have disappeared. All those things, you know, our health, we've regained our health, but we still have our home that we can't sell.
Right, yeah.
We've been out of our home for 2.5 years. We haven't been able to sell it. It's hard to let go of a house you've built, you know, with your own hands. Like, my wife and I, we've built that house with our own hands. We've put so many reminders inside the walls of what was going on that day, how many children we had at one point or another. And there are so many memories. It's so hard to let go, but we have to. We have to go on, but we can't let go now because there's nobody that's willing to buy it.
Wow.
Mm. So there's been the odd prospective buyer, but every time they hear about the wind farm, they either don't come to look or they turn away right away. It's a real deterrent to selling a house.
What about the wind farm? Would they be willing to buy it?
No, they've always maintained that they wanted to be a good neighbor and they would do anything to... To prove that, but they've always maintained they were not in the house buying business. And you know, we've had some noise testing done. The government found that the wind farm was excessively noisy.
Mm-hmm.
The government forced the wind company to mitigate the noise, to take measures to mitigate the noise. They did take some measures during some weather conditions, and the government said it was okay that the measures were adequate to mitigate the noise. So there was another round of noise testing done, and the government reviewed the report, and they said it was okay. But we had that report analyzed, and the report shows that 30% of the time the wind turbines are exceeding Ontario noise guidelines. So they're allowed to operate at that level with the government's blessing. So I don't understand how it can be.
Yeah.
It should be illegal for the wind farm to be operating, with that much noise.
Okay.
And there's a latest report that came out lately that says there's a danger zone around wind turbines, a 1,300 feet danger zone. You shouldn't have houses. There shouldn't be any children allowed to play within that range, within that perimeter. 1,300 feet.
Yeah.
And we are at 1,000 feet from a wind turbine, so.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's really ridiculous for anybody to put a wind turbine or maintain that it's okay to have a wind turbine 300 meters from your house.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there's no government intervention or anything, you know, to come to our assistance.
So how long has this struggle been going on?
This struggle? The wind farm was... they began constructing the wind farm in 2004. In May of 2004, there were two wind turbines up, approximately 4,000 feet each from the house. And the neighbors were saying how loud they were. They were sleeping with earplugs at night. And and they found they were close to the house, but construction continued in the fall of 2004, and in February of 2005, all 17 were up and running, and well, the noise was just unbearable then.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everything just went downhill from there.
Mm-hmm.
If we would have known what would have happened, what was going to happen to us, we would have moved out right away. But
right.
We didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know. So
yeah, I guess there wouldn't be much to go on either.
We
I
just
think.
Kept the kids there too long. Like our youngest child was 5 then, and he was sleeping on the side of the house facing the windmills, and he would wrap himself up in his blankets with a fan at his head, and he would have a lot of trouble falling asleep. It would be 10, 11 o'clock at night before he'd fall asleep, and he told us some nights he thought he was going to die. He was so afraid.
Mm-hmm.
But that's no way to for children to live, to have to live.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If listeners were interested in supporting the education about this issue or supporting yourself, is there something set up for them to do that? Is there a way they could do that?
All I have is a website.
Yeah.
It tells our story and things like that.
Yeah.
It's dangerwind.org.
Okay.
www.dangerwind.org. It tells our story, has a few pictures of our house and the turbines and things like that. And it tells you exactly what has happened to us.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's very educational.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's very important, too, because I mean, as wind turbines are coming up all over the place, it's a huge industry. And I know us in British Columbia, we're getting some of our first big operations going up here soon. And it's definitely very important for people to know. So,
yes.
Yeah.
I did email David Suzuki in the past, and I got a couple of responses from him. You know, one was very sympathetic that, you know, he was sorry that we had to go through this, and he wished that, you know, he didn't think these big wind farms should be sprouting up all over the place, that there should be like 3 or 4 servicing parts of communities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That these big, you know, wind farms consisting of hundreds of turbines at a time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you the best, and thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today. So there we have it. I hope you really enjoyed this episode of Sustainable Futures. If you wish to hear any episode of Sustainable Futures again, I recommend going to the website radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. I have uploaded all episodes on there, and you can listen to any of our past episodes, and within the next week, also this one, once more. So, coming up in future episodes, we're working on a few things. One thing you can look forward to is an interview with Annie Miller of the Wilderness Committee. I also interviewed Cameron Cotes about algae and the properties of algae. This is one of the miracle cures for a lot of, well, it's a potential miracle cure for a lot of the questions of how to live sustainably. And you can also look forward to another interview that Kimberly Tay did, also along the slow movement, and a fellow who's doing workshops, traveling around doing workshops on a bus. On how to live sustainably. There's all kinds of things going on in this world towards the effort to make it sustainable. So thank you for listening once again. My name is Ryan Fletcher, and I am wishing you a sustainable future.